A flash pot of rage exploded in Max's chest. Blood was running from the stab wound to soak the hem of his underwear. "You'll kill us, huh? Is that what you'll do, you crazy fuck?" He stepped toward Shelley. "What if I kill you first, huh, Shell? What if I kill you?" Shelley cocked his head at Max, a predatory gesture. Was he baiting Max? Shelley sucked back snot and hawked up phlegm. He opened his mouth and showed them the oyster of thick mucus on his tongue. Max saw things wriggling in it. Shelley's mouth curved into a smile as he diddled the oyster around on his tongue. "You're sick, Shelley," Newton said. Max figured he wasn't just talking about the worms, either. "We found these mushrooms. You could take them. They might flush them out." Shelley's head swung side to side like a pendulum, then he spat. Max dodged. The spit sailed past his leg. It hit the dirt and picked up dust. "It's squirming. Jesus, his spit is squirming." Max's first urge was to stamp on it like he would a revolting bug, but he resisted the impulse. They backed away as Shelley struggled to stand. Max was sure he'd just keep hawking until he hit the mark, that or bite them or even lick them. He'd infect them for the pure sport of it. Max's heels hit the edge of the campfire. The rocks forming the ring weren't all that big. Some of them were fist size, some smaller. He picked one up, testing its weight. It felt good in his hand. It felt mean. Shelley was coming. Max pegged the rock. The muscles flexed over his ribcage and caused the cut on his belly to tear even wider. The stone whanged off Shelley's knee. Max thought he saw something crumple and sag under his pants and wondered if he'd shattered Shelley's kneecap, and in that moment he was so hopeful that he had. Shelley squawked and fell, clutching at his leg. Max picked up another rock. "The next one you'll catch with your face, Shell," he said. His voice was coolly businesslike, but his bloody hands were trembling. Shelley hissed at them, actually hissed, like a vampire who'd had a cross jammed in his face. He scrambled away, retreating up the dirt path behind the cabin. Max pursued, following Shelley until the path tracked into the pines. He paused. Could Shelley be waiting in ambush? Turning reluctantly, he doubled back to Newton. "Where is he?" "In the woods," Max said. "He was limping bad. I might have broken something." He considered this possibility, his lips forming a hard, thin line. "Good. I hope so." "What if he comes back?" "I don't know, Newt. I just don't know." They turned their attention to Ephraim. The wind had blown the sleeping bag back over his body, which was a small mercy. Max said, "We got to bury him, Newt." "Yes," Newton said. "We ought to do that. It's the only way he'll get to heaven." It was dark by the time they put Ephraim in the ground. But first Newton bandaged Max's wound. The edges of the cut were clotted with dirt. Newton debrided them as best he could with salt water fetched up from the beach and dressed it with bandages from the medical kit. Blood seeped through the gauze almost as soon as he applied it. It would have to do. The medical kit was almost empty. They buried Ephraim in the ground south of the campfire. It was softer, almost sandy. They used a collapsible shovel Newton had bought at the army surplus. When its handle snapped off, they used their hands. When the grave was finished, they dragged Ephraim to it. The sleeping bag's neoprene shell slid over the ground with effortless ease. At first, they were terrified the hole wouldn't be deep enough and that they'd have to dig deeper while Ephraim's body sat right next to them. It was deep enough. They scooped dirt over and patted it down to discourage animals from digging the body up. Newton recited a short prayer that his mother often said. He didn't know that it really applied, but it was the only one he knew by heart. "God in heaven, hear my prayer. Keep me in thy loving care. Be my guide in all I do. Bless all those who love me too. Amen." Afterward, their eyes were hot and dry. Max wanted to cry, if only to release the tension in his chest, but his body wouldn't release the tears because his mind wouldn't allow it. It seemed inconceivable that Eve could be in a hole in the ground. Just last week, Max had raced him across the monkey bars at recess. Eve won. Afterward, they'd sat in the shade by the baseball diamond and ate their lunches. Eve's mom had packed some crackers for him, They'd stuffed their mouths with the dry squares and seen who could recite the alphabet fastest. They were spitting out shards of cracker and laughing like mad. Eef had won that game, too. Eef won just about everything where Kent wasn't involved. Max and Ephraim would never hike to the bluffs behind his house, staring up at the stars as the sheer waters called from the cliffs. They'd never talk about girls and candy and their dreams and who'd win in a fight, Batman or James Bond. They'd made a pact to be friends forever, but forever could be so, so brief. Max curled into a wretched ball beside the grave. Eef was dead. Everyone was dead or missing or insane. The cabin was in splinters and things were falling apart, which seemed so unfair. Where were the adults? Max couldn't believe someone hadn't come for them yet. His parents were always nagging him to be on time, to be responsible, and to think of others. Well then, what the fuck? His folks were full of shit. Or else they'd be here, and Kent's parents, including his hot shit policeman dad, and Newt's and Eef's too. Didn't they give a shit about them? Maybe they were all complicit in it, a plot. They'd all bought into it. Get them out to the island and cut off their escape route. Let nature take its course. No, that was idiot talk. Their parents would never do that. The fact that they weren't here actually spoke to how dire the situation must be, because this wasn't nature, was it? This was something else. Those things, the way they spread infection, the way they spread. Newton got a fire going. The warmth helped the anger and confusion melt out of Max's brain. They were replaced by exhaustion. He felt as if he were wearing one of those heavy lead coats the dental hygienist draped over his shoulders before taking x-rays. He lay beside the fire. Almost instantly, he was fast asleep. Chapter 40. Eat. 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 Shelley rose in the dead of night to hunt. He'd found a cool, dark place to hide. He'd limped into the woods, clutching at his hurt knee. He eventually came upon a cavern burrowed into the island's bedrock. It was deep and narrow, and it held the tang of salt. Perhaps it was fed by an aquifer that led out to the sea. He lay in the sheltering dark, listening to the water trickle on the rock. This place suited him. It would be a wonderful place to give birth. The boys, Max and Newton, skinny and fat, Jack Spratt and his wife, they thought he was sick. They couldn't be more wrong. He wasn't sick. He was simply changing into something entirely new. He could feel it inside of him, a vast darkness, itchy black, unfurling like the petals of a night-blooming flower. It would hurt. Oh, yes. But then change always did. The hateful boys had wounded him. They may have hurt his babies, but no, he could feel them squirming contentedly inside of him. Thank goodness. The boys needed to die. Shelley had been planning on killing them anyway. He wasn't sure it'd be much fun at this point, although it might provide the same fleeting thrill he'd experienced while drowning Kent, a fizzy, sudsy bath bubble feeling in his veins. But now he'd kill them as a simple matter of principle. They had harmed him, which meant, inadvertently or otherwise, they had harmed his babies. And a father always defended his children. Shelley exited the cave. The night enveloped him. He was part of it, dark just like it. Eat. 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 Oh my, weren't they so needy? So hungry. They asked so much of him, as all children must, but Shelley was only too happy to give. He came upon a diseased elm. Its trunk was pocked with tiny bore holes. He tore away a chunk of bark. His strength was immense, and clawed inside the rotted tree. When he withdrew it, his hand was teeming with wood lice. He crunched them into paste. They fidgeted on his tongue and tickled his throat when he swallowed. He giggled hoarsely while sucking the last few lice off his fingers. Good, good. Eat more, more, more. Shelley caught his reflection in a pool of moonlight-sheened water. He was horribly wrinkled. It looked as if spiders with legs of thin steel wire had battened onto his flesh, curling and tightening, trenching deep lines into his face. His stomach was a swollen gourd. It bulged through his shirt and over the band of his trousers. Its pale circumference was strung with blue veins and sloshed with a dangerous, exciting weight. In the dank wastes of his brain, his undermind, you could say, a species of mute fear twined into his thoughts. "This isn't right," a voice said. "You're being eaten alive." A wave of acidic warmth washed through those thoughts, burning them away. Oh, they asked so much of him. It was tiring feeding all those hungry mouths, and the mouths just beget more mouths and more mouths and more and more and... Shelley slid down the incline to the campsite. Firelight crept around the cabin's shattered angles. He snuck around the far side and surveyed the fire pit. Max was sleeping. He imagined grabbing his hair and jamming him face first into the white-hot coals. He pictured the silly boy's face melting like a latex Halloween mask. The fat one, Newton, was staring right at him. His heart jogged in his chest. Ba-dump. Newton sat on the far side of the fire. The flames played over his eyes, which seemed to be staring directly at him. Eat, 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 eat. In a moment, he thought. First I have to kill them. Then I'll be alone. Then I can give birth in peace. Then we can all play. But how would he do it? He'd lost his knife. Was Newton really looking at him? "I see you, Shelley." Newton pulled a knife out of his pocket. His knife. He unfolded it carefully and stabbed the tip into a log. The knife quivered in the wood. An invitation? "Go away. Get out of here. Now," Newton whispered. A cold, slippery eel ghosted through the ventricles of Shelley's heart, cinching itself tight. He retreated like a groveling animal. He wanted them dead so badly, but he was so hungry. Shelley's stomach swayed as he tripped sideways, whimpering softly as his belly brushed the edge of the cabin. For a moment he felt it might detach and burst like a water balloon on the forest floor. Then he'd lose everything, his children, his precious babies. Shelley was in the forest again. Night folded over him. The hunger was hellish, unspeakable, but one must suffer for what one loves. He shambled through the woods, eating whatever. It came to him in flashes. In one moment, he was hunched under a log, devouring eggs, maybe termite eggs whose sacks burst between his teeth like albino jelly beans. Next, he was along the shoreline, ankle deep in the freezing surf, gorging himself on the decayed carapace of some creature that had once crawled in the sea. So tasty. It slipped between his numbed fingers and he collapsed into the surf, squealing like a piglet, clutching at his stinking prize. Later, much later, Shelley lay in the darkness with the cool trickle of the rock. He was screaming, or maybe crying, he couldn't tell. There was a watery echo down there that did funny things to his voice. None of that really mattered anymore, anyway. His home, his foolish parents, his teachers, the many jars buried in the backyard full of his playthings, all in various states of decomposition. That was his old life, his silly, forgettable life. He was going to be a great daddy. The best. From the sworn testimony of Stonewall Brewer, given before the Federal Investigatory Board in connection with the events occurring on Falstaff Island, Prince Edward Island. Question. Please state your name and rank, sir. Answer. Stonewall Brewer, Admiral, Canadian Navy. Question. Stonewall? Answer. I always tell people that my mother must have had a premonition. Question. Very prescient of her. Admiral, when were you made aware of the events occurring on Falstaff Island? Answer. About 0300. Can't recall the exact time on the display of the clock beside my bed, although the call was tracked so we could get you that info if need be. Question. What were you told? Answer. That a nonspecific contagion of unknown lethality had breached containment. Question. Were you aware of the nature of this contagion? Answer. At the time, no. Question. No idea at all? Answer. You will find you'll only have to ask me a question once, my friend. The first answer is the answer you'll get every time. Question. Only seeking to clarify matters for the court, Admiral. What is your experience, if any, with the spread or neutralization of a contagion? Answer. If I had no experience, I don't imagine it would have been my phone ringing in the dead of night. I spearheaded the containment efforts on the SARS outbreak that hit Metropolitan Toronto back in 2002. Question. If I recall, 44 people died during that outbreak. Answer. Could have been a lot more. That was my first rodeo. Question. And all you knew about the contagion in North Point was... Answer. I hit the ground with the intel available at the time. We had one case of infection. Question. That would be Tom Paget. Answer. That's right, the guinea pig. Typhoid Tom. It was SOP. Quarantine the area, detain all residents, set up a zone of infection. Nothing comes in, and most importantly, nothing gets out. That's how we treat icebergs. Question. Icebergs? Answer. That's how threats like this are known internally. The idea is that only 10% of an iceberg is visible. The other 90% is below the water. So when we've got a threat without set parameters, one that could be huge, we call it an iceberg. Question. And containment was vital? Answer. Always is, but even more so in this case. Word came down that we could be up against a three-tier bug. The virus could be carrier-borne, waterborne, or airborne. The terrible threesome. Question. What were your orders? Answer. I don't take orders as a rule. It's my duty to dole them out. Question. What was your agenda then? Answer. It was full scale, total neutralization. Quarantine the island and all life forms on it. Nothing comes or goes. I had to enact some very serious measures. Question. Such as? Answer. First off, we couldn't do anything about the kids. That was rough, no two ways about it, but we couldn't risk it. Question. Anything else? Answer. When I said nothing comes, nothing goes, I meant it. If a seagull took off from that island and tried to fly back to land, I had a recon sniper shoot it out of the sky. I had military personnel in hazmat suits fish the corpse out of the water. After the island was cleared, I ordered 4 million gallons of Anatec Blue to be dumped into the surrounding waters. We call that stuff Blue Death. It kills everything indiscriminately. Marine life, plants, plankton, protozoa. The eggheads at CDC told me I ought to make another pass just to be sure. A few Earth mother types got their knickers in a twist over that. We razed the island, too. Took 4 separate napalm strikes. You know how hard it is to find napalm? My marching orders were to render Falstaff Island biologically sterile, not one living thing left. Maybe there's a few amoebas still swimming around. I'm constantly amazed at the tenacity of all life on this planet. But if anything's still alive, it's not for a lack of trying on my part. Chapter 41. Max dreamed he was in the mortuary with his father. It's the only chance he got to see him some days. People didn't die that often in North Point, but they did like to hunt and fish, meaning his father had a backlog of taxidermy projects. The nature of taxidermy being what it is, framing the anatomies of dead animals before they begin to decay, timing is everything. Of course, the same held true for human anatomies. His father worked in a white-tiled room beneath the city courthouse. The air held the sharp undertone of charcoal from the air purifier that pumped away in the corner. The shelves and fixtures were stainless steel. A huge steel slab dominated the room's center. Max watched his father work. He wore a long white coat, the kind pharmacists wore, and an apron of black vulcanized rubber. His dad whistled while he worked. Today it was the old gray mare. The old gray mare, she ain't what she used to be, ain't what she used to be, ain't what she used to be. A woman's body lay on the table. She had died at a very old age. A white sheet was draped over her hips, but her chest was bare. Her breasts were long and tubular, as if something had pulled them out of shape. Her empty sockets were withered like 2 halves of a cored-out squash, forgotten for days on a countertop. His father worked with his back to Max. He picked up an ocular suction cup. "What happens is," he told Max in a weird sing-song voice, "the eyeballs get sucked down into your head after you die. Did you know that, Maxie? His father never called him Maxie. He thumbed the ocular cup into the woman's socket, tiny barbs on the cup attached to her naked eyeball. He pulled. The eyeball sucked back into its socket with the sound of a boot being pulled out of thick mud. All better. His father was whistling again, a sputtering, wheezing noise. It sounded as if it was being made with a different orifice altogether. Fear slammed into Max's belly. His father turned. At first, Max thought his head had been submitted to some incredible pressure. It was flattened, elongated, pancaked. It projected upward and curled over on itself like a lotus petal. Oh, Maxie, Maxie, Maxie. A worm's head jutted from his father's lab coat. It was the greasy white of a toadstool. Noxious fluid leaked from its ribbed exterior, dribbling down to form a pumicey crust on the collar. The old gray mare, thee ain't what thee youth to be. The voice was coming from a pit in the middle of its head, round and ineffably dark like the air in a caved-in mine shaft. The pit was studded with translucent teeth that looked like glassine tusks. The old gray mare, his worm father sang, swaying and burping up goo. A pair of yellow dots glowed in the direct center of the pit, looking like the headlights of a car shining up from the bottom of the ocean. Before he woke up, Max swore he could hear another voice coming from the deepest part of the worm, the ongoing scream of his own father trapped somewhere inside of it. Newton was shaking him. Max! Max! He jerked up. The sunlight stabbed at his eyes. The dream drained thickly from his brain pan, departing his body through uncontrollable twitches and shivers. You okay? You were screaming in your sleep, Newton said. Yeah, just a bad dream. It was morning. He didn't know how long he'd slept. His spine was knotted and his gut kicked over sourly. They walked to the shore. The ships still charted their distant orbits. They were like the heat shimmer on the highway. No matter how fast you drove, it didn't get any closer or draw any further away. Max wanted to scream at them, but why bother? A waste of his swiftly diminishing energy. Newton rubbed the sleep crust out of his eyes and wandered toward Oliver McCanty's boat. He hauled on the motor's ripcord. The motor went wah-wah, the same discouraging sound it had made when they'd tried a few days before. Newton pulled it again. 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 He thought about the poster in science class, Albert Einstein, shock-haired with his tongue stuck out above the quote, "The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results." Defeated, he let go of the cord, staggered back, tripped, and sat down on his ass. He cupped his hands over his eyes, lowered his head between his knees, and wept. "Hey," Max said. "Hey, Newt, it's..." But Newton was too far gone. The pent-up sobs ripped out of his throat. They were the most wretched noises Max had ever heard. He put an arm around Newton's shoulders and felt the tension, like grasping a railroad track in advance of the onrushing locomotive. He didn't tell Newton everything would be okay because it wasn't. It would never be as it had been. The past had a perfection that the future could never hold. Max just let Newton cry. His sobs trailed off. He drew a few hitching breaths and said, "Sorry, Max, that wasn't very..." He hiccuped twice, exhaled steadily, and said, "Wasn't very cool of me. WWAMD, he said more to himself than to Max. "He sure as hell wouldn't cry like a baby. I don't think being cool really matters now, do you?" Newton let go of one more shuddery breath. "No, I guess not." Max walked to the boat, cracked the motor casing. Inside were two small holes where the spark plug should go. He thought of his dream, the two yellow dots glowing up from the dark pit. His mind jogged. Two revelations joined in his head like puzzle pieces slotting into place. He must have eaten them. "What?" Newton said. "Who did? Ate what?" "Spark plugs," Max said softly. The man, the stranger, he swallowed the spark plugs, ate them. Ate them? Why would he do? Newton thought about the man, how cadaverous he looked, skinny as a pipe cleaner. Thought about Kent and Shelley, too. Yes, he decided, the man probably was hungry enough to eat spark plugs. He ate them because he was hungry, huh? Max shrugged. Could be. Or maybe he didn't want to be found. Without spark plugs, the boat won't start, right? Maybe he figured the best place to hide them was inside of himself. How do you know? Because I saw them, Newt. When the scoutmaster cut him open to get the worm out, I saw them shining in, well, his stomach, I guess. You're sure? Positive. 10 minutes later, they were in the cabin, standing over the dead stranger. They tried not to pay much attention to the state of his body. It seemed wrong, somehow, desecrating him with their eyes. They tried to focus on him abstractly, as a puzzle or a riddle. They had to solve him in the easiest and safest way. Still, they couldn't help but stare. His elbows and knees had been eaten away by something. That was the most obvious thing. Animals? Insects? How could that have happened so quickly, though? Or perhaps the skin had been so thin that the bones had worn through all on their own, the way your knees will wear through a cheap pair of jeans. His face had fallen into itself. It was distracting. They couldn't drag their eyes away. Newton draped a dish towel over it. Do you think the worms are all dead? Max nodded. They have to be, right? That's what the scoutmaster said. Once the host is dead, the worms die too. Newton still seemed doubtful. What about eggs? They might still be here, right? Eggs don't need food, do they? Max set his fingertips lightly on the man's wrist. He's cold. He's been gone a long time. Okay, but put something on your hands first. They found a pair of dishwashing gloves. Newton scrounged up 2 empty plastic bread bags. The gloves go on first, then the bread bags over top. Then I'm going to tape your shirt sleeves to the bag so nothing can get in. Good idea. The sun shone brightly through the cleaved roof, glossing insects that hummed over the body. Already the island was taking over the cabin. Mold edged up the walls, fungus grew in the cracks. Soon the foundations would rot and disintegrate. Maybe that was for the best, Max thought. Try not to breathe too deeply, Newton said. Okay, fine. You're creeping me out. Newton gave him a bewildered look. Max, jeez, you're about to reach inside a dead guy. You better be creeped out. Max pushed his fingers into the pasty lips of the wound, through a thin membrane of gelatinized blood, and into the dead man's abdomen. Cold oatmeal, he told himself. You're just rooting around in a bowl of cold oatmeal. The man's insides had liquefied and turned granular. They didn't seem to have any definition anymore, no organs or intestines. His hand moved through layers of cold, chunky tissue that felt a little like mashed bananas. Mashed bananas, then. You're looking for spark plugs in a big pile of mashed bananas. Max's hand slipped into a squelchy pocket. A rude farting noise. The air filled with a rotted, sulfury swamp gas stink. Max's gut roiled, but nothing came out, just a dry heave that filled his mouth with the taste of bitter bile. His hand closed upon something hard. He pulled it out. Holy crow, Newton said. The spark plug lay in Max's cupped palm. It was smeared in pinkish-gray curds, but they could clearly make out the word champion down its side. It took Max a minute to find the second one. He had to sink his hand in fairly far, almost to the elbow, ripping through some rubbery kinked hoses in the man's abdomen to get at it. Tube-like things that tore up like the witch grass growing in the shallows of North Point Bay. When it was done, the spark plugs lay side by side on the floor. The boys grinned at each other. It had to be the best news they'd ever gotten. They had to grope through a dead man's insides to get it, but still. They were both suffused with a feeling they hadn't truly experienced in days. Hope. Chapter 42. They carried the spark plugs down to the shore. Max was so excited that he didn't even bother to strip the wash gloves off. The sea came into view over the rocky scree. For the first time since they could recall, that vista didn't seem so vast or the distance to North Point so very daunting. Newton popped the motor canopy. He frowned. Should we just screw them in like that, all covered in, you know? You think it matters?
It could.
We should clean them first. Max said, won't that ruin them? Newton pointed at the words running down the side of the plugs in small green type, marine standard. That means they're waterproof. They washed off the gray-pink curds in the frigid sea. They did so carefully, the way you'd wash oil off a baby mallard. When they were clean, Newton put them on the big flat rock to dry. Newton chose it specifically because it was large and flat and flecked with pink granite, a very peculiar rock. He chose it because he wanted to be absolutely sure they could find the spark plugs again. Max knocked on the motor's gas tank. His knuckles brought forth a hollow wonk. Sounds almost empty.
What about the generator? Newton said. It should have gas.
They returned to the campsite. The cap had been wrenched off the generator's gas tank. The surrounding earth held the gleam of spilled gasoline. Max rocked the generator. Nothing sloshed inside. A pall of hopelessness fell over them. The universe was aligned against them. Why? It struck Max that the universe ought to find better targets. Had to be plenty of psychopaths and deadbeats out there, right? Why pick on a couple of kids? The universe could be a stone-cold asshole sometimes.
What about the emergency jerry can?
Newton said. The Scoutmaster kept it in the cellar. The steps groaned as they traced their way down the stairs. Bars of sunlight fell through cracks in the cabin floor. The cellar was eerily clean. Not a single spider web, none of the sickly gray mushrooms Max had spied growing in the corners when he was down here the other day. God, Kent must have eaten them, he thought queasily. Max picked the jerry can up. It was joyously heavy. There's at least a gallon in here, he said. Maybe the universe wasn't such an asshole after all, but it sure as hell made you suffer something fierce. Case in point, when they returned to the boat, the spark plugs were gone. The pink-flecked rock was bare, except for two wet spots where they had lain. Newton actually laughed, a strangled squawk of disbelief.
They're here, he said, shaking his head, a strained smile on his face. No, no, they're here somewhere, I'm sure of it. Where the hell else could they be?
The boys waded into the frigid surf and poked doggedly around the rocks. Maybe a big wave had crashed up on shore and pulled them into the sea. But that couldn't be. The rocks were dry as saltines. Their ankles turned pink, then blue. Max stomped out of the water.
Are you kidding? Where the fuck are they, Newt? How should I know? I left them here.
You should have put them in your pocket.
So it's my fault? Are you serious? What do you think happened? A fish jumped up and swallowed them? A bird flew off with them?
Okay, what if a bird did pick them up? A pelican, like the ones perched on the buoys out at Barker Bay. My dad says they swallow soda cans.
God, don't be so stupid.
Newton adopted a superior tone as if he were talking to a preschooler who'd just claimed the tooth fairy was real.
Pelicans are shore birds.
So what's all this then, Newt? Max spread his arms out. Is this the shore, or are you just a big fat moron?
Pelicans are mainland shorebirds. This is an island. Mainland shorebirds don't fly to islands. Do you understand that, or do I need to draw you a map?
Max took two steps forward, planted his palms in Newton's chest, and shoved. Newton went down with a jolt. Max expected him to stay down, just as he always did. But instead, Newton propelled himself off the rocks and drove his shoulder into Max's stomach, knocking the wind out of him. They tumbled across the shore, striking at each other. Their blows didn't have much pop, but they were thrown with cruel intentions. Newton's fist collided with Max's nose, and the impact set Max's skull bone ringing like a cathedral bell. Max rolled over, snarling, and his elbow caught Newton under the chin. Blood leapt into the air, startlingly bright in the morning sun.
They shoved away from each other, breathing hard. Max's nose was a squashed berry. Blood lay stunned across his cheeks. The wound in his abdomen had opened up again. Blood was dripping from Newton's chin. They eyed each other warily, trying to gauge whether the fight was over or this was just an interlude before hostilities commenced anew. "Are we done?" Max mumbled.
"Yeah, we're done," Newton said with downcast eyes.
They sat in silence as the adrenaline burnt out of their systems. In its wake came dull relief. It was like tripping the release on a steam gauge. They could breathe easier and think straighter. Max offered Newton his hand. Newton took it. Max pulled him up.
"That was a waste of time and energy," Newton said.
"Yeah.
I don't know why guys do it. I feel sick. I taste blood between my teeth."
"Sorry."
Newton shrugged. "Don't be. I did it too."
He smiled out of the side of his mouth.
"Bet you didn't see that coming, did you? WWAMD.
"What?"
"Nothing. Your nose okay?"
Max gripped the tip of his nose, wiggled it.
"Hurts, but I don't think it's broken."
They looked out over the sea.
"It was Shelley," Max said.
"Yeah," Newton said. "I was thinking the same thing."
"You figure he chucked the spark plugs into the sea?"
"I don't think so."
"You think he took them with him?"
"Uh-huh."
"You figure he wants us to come find him?"
"Uh-huh.
Hide and go seek. Fetch, boy, fetch."
Max sighed. He felt about 100 years old.
Red Rover, please send crazy asshole Shelley over.
Ollie, Ollie, oxen free."
"Come on," said Max. "We got to find him."
Chapter 43. They set off in pursuit of Shelley just after noon.
"I got my animal tracking badge last year," Newton said to lighten the mood. "But, you know, they don't give out a man tracking badge."
They decided to search the areas off the main trail. Shelley couldn't have gone too far. Before leaving, they ate the last of the berries they'd collected, the ones for Eve. They tasted bitter, but they'd need the energy. Newton packed his field book into his knapsack along with a map of the island, some rope, and a flashlight. Max snapped a branch off an elm tree. It was as thick and long as a mop handle. He sharpened one end to a wicked point.
"I don't want him coming near us, Newt."
"How else are we going to get the plugs? Maybe we can convince him to toss them to us."
"You think?"
Newt looked dubious.
"You don't figure he'd swallow them, do you?"
They set off on that unhopeful note. The sun was obscured behind ashy clouds. The temperature had dipped. The daylight was already starting to fade. They were bone-tired before they even took their first steps on the steep switchbacking trail.
"I saw him last night, you know," Newton said. "Shell, he came round while you were sleeping."
"Wait, what? What for?" Max shivered involuntarily. "What did he do?"
"Just crouched there, watching, you know, the way Shelley does."
"So did you do anything?"
Newton shook his head. "I just watched him right back. Honestly, I figured it wouldn't be so bad if he died out here. I know that's awful, but..."
Newton held Max's gaze when he said it. Max glimpsed, not for the first time in the last few days, that seam of stoniness running through Newton. It was unexpected, coming from someone who usually rolled over and showed his soft belly. If anyone had asked Max who'd still be standing after all this, he would have said Kent, maybe Eve. But Newton had that survivalist's outlook. It wasn't about the badges he'd earned or the fact that he was best at starting a fire. Newton had inner resources that the rest of the boys simply didn't possess, even Max himself. Getting teased your whole life must force you to grow some pretty hard bark.
"I don't mean that we should hurt him," Newton said. "When we get back to the mainland, we should tell the police he's still here and sick, and maybe they'll be able to do something."
"I know. I'm just saying, if they don't get here in time..."
"Let's not talk about it, okay, Newt?" What should we talk about?
I don't know. Maybe food?
Newt grinned.
Yes.
They covered all their favorites. The peach cobbler at Frida's diner that came with a scoop of just starting to melt vanilla ice cream. The porterhouse steaks Max's father cooked up at the annual summer barbecue, 2 inches thick and marbled with rich, melty fat. The pies from Sammy's Pizza down in Tignish. You had to pay $5 extra for delivery to North Point, but it was so worth it to scarf down one of those slightly chewy slices covered in little spicy pepperonis and mozzarella cheese.
Oh, Newton said excitedly. The cannolis at Stella's Bakery, the best.
He threw his hands up with an air of finality, as if he'd settled some hard-fought argument with a fact that was beyond dispute.
Crunchy on the outside, filled with sweet cheese and chocolate chips on the inside. They crack apart in your mouth, and that filling just...
His tongue inched out of his mouth.
Splooshes. It splooshes onto your taste buds. I could eat about 1 million of them right now.
Max bent over, clutching his belly. Newton's rhapsody had left him a bit lightheaded.
Crap, maybe we ought to talk about something else.
They found a skunk den. It was clear by the smell, and what may have been a fox run, but no sign of Shelley. They debated where he might be hiding, or whether he was hiding at all.
Maybe he's following us,
Max said, a possibility that spooked the hell out of them.
We should follow our noses, Newton said. Like Toucan Sam, you know? The Stranger and Scoutmaster Tim and even Kent, they all started to smell sweet, right? Like gross sweet.
Max nodded.
Yeah, like rotten-y kinda. Like someone's puke after he ate 2 cones of cotton candy at the fair and got on the zipper.
I guess like that, yeah. So if we smell that, we'll know Shelley's close.
Okay.
The sun slipped lower in its western altar. Twilight piled up along the horizon in ever-darkening layers. The boys hunched their shoulders into the brisk wind. Newton laughed and said,
You know, my mom's gonna kill me when this is all over.
Max loved that Newton still thought that way, that he still saw a time when this would all be over, when they would be home, safe.
Why would she, Newt? For what?
For all this, getting myself into it.
None of this is our fault, Newt. It's just some awful thing that happened.
I know. My mom's just like that sometimes. She cares too much, you know? Makes her crazy. Remember that flower baby project we did for home ec?
Of course Max did. The teacher had given them each a bag of flour to take care of as if it were a baby.
Some students hadn't taken it seriously. Eve tossed his baby off the second floor's supply shed and hooted as it detonated across the hopscotch court. Kent duct-taped the entire bag to avoid ruptures. The teacher frowned on this.
You wouldn't duct-tape an actual baby, would you? She'd asked Kent.
Are you sure? Kent replied with a sly smile, earning sniggers from the rest of the class.
I really tried to take good care of that flower, Newton said. I drew a face on the sack and everything. But the thing is, I've got sweaty hands. It's a condition. Sweaty armpits and feet, too. Can't help it. Every time I touched it, the sack got wet. It started to come apart. I told myself to stop fussing with it, but I couldn't help it. I kept touching it just to know it was there and safe. It ripped a little and then a little more until it finally ripped right open. My flower baby. Well, died. I guess I killed it.
It was just a stupid sack of flour, Newt.
Newton made a face that said, You don't get it, man.
I'm just saying that sometimes the more you care for something, the more damage you do. Not on purpose, right? You end up hurting the things you love just because you're trying so hard. That's what Mom does with me sometimes. She wants me to be so safe that it ends up hurting me in a weird way. But I get it, you know? It must be the hardest thing in the world, caring for someone, trying to make sure that person doesn't come to harm.
The sky was the color of a bone-deep bruise when Max caught the first traces of a high, sweet stink.
You smell that?
Max whispered.
Newton nodded. Where's it coming from?
They held their noses up, zeroing in on the location where it seemed to emanate from, a cavern set into a shale-strewn hillside. They retired out of earshot to formulate a plan. Max said, "Should we yell down to him? Maybe he's sleeping. Why wake him up? We can just pluck them off him. Right out of his pocket? If that's where he's keeping them, I guess we'll have to." "Okay, fine," Max said, expelling a few rabbity breaths. "But what if he's awake? What if he fights back? Are you asking if we should hurt him?" "I don't know. I guess so. I mean, you already cracked him over the head, so..." Newton bit his lip. "Let's just hope he's asleep. Rock, paper, scissors for who goes in first?" Newton's hand came down in a clenched fist. Max's hand came down flat. Paper covered rock. "Forget it," Max said. "We go down side by side." Newton shook his head. "It looks too narrow, and anyway, fair is fair."
Chapter 44. The cavern floor dipped just past the cave mouth, plunging them into darkness, a sticky, coagulated darkness that coated their skin like oil. It was as if the rods and cones in their eyes had been shut off like flicking a light switch. Click. Newton was in the lead, clutching with both hands the crude spear Max had made. He figured this was the blackness that must exist at the bottom of the sea, a blackness prowled by sightless things whose skin was so pale and gelatinous you could see the inner workings of their bodies. Things with nightmare anatomies that would evoke cries of horror were they ever glimpsed in sunlight. Blind eyes bulging atop skinny stalks, rubbery mouths big enough to swallow a Hyundai, rows of tiny, needle-like teeth. Such creatures could only survive in the deeps. Their bodies had no protection against the sun. Their skin would roast and disintegrate to mush before they even reached the surface. But they had learned to adapt to their lack of sight. They jostled and bumped with the other creatures that lived beneath the light, occasionally lashing out with barbs or tentacles or teeth.
WWAMD, he thought.
The answer came swiftly. Alex Markson would be scared shitless. Anyone else on Earth ought to be scared shitless, too. The boys' collective breath came hot in their ears. Their boots sent little avalanches of shale skittering down the cavern slope. Water trickled over the rocks somewhere below, a sea-seeking tributary. The air was laden with the smell of sweet corruption. Max's hand was wrapped tightly around Newton's flashlight. He had not switched it on yet. Newton would tell him when. Darkness pushed at his eyeballs. Steady fear pulsed behind them, a monstrous pressure massing behind his eyes. With darkness pressing from the front and fear pressing from behind, he was terrified his eyeballs would burst like grapes in a vice. This was the strongest evidence yet that something must be terribly the matter with Shelley. No sane human being would want to hide out down here. They inched their way down the incline, hands outflung so they wouldn't run face first into the rock. The cavern walls were slick with some viscid substance, algae maybe. Max pictured tiny albino crabs scuttling along the gluey stuff, their pincers tick-tick-ticking. He imagined millions of them forming a chittering umbrella above their heads. His cheek came into contact with a shelf of slimed rock. It felt like a giant, raspy tongue. That he didn't scream out in terror had to count as a minor miracle. The darkness was disorienting. Nothing could moor itself to it, not even their breathing, which seemed to float out only to hit some unseen barrier and rebound back at them. It could make a person go mad simply because it consumed them, creeping into their mouths and into their ears and up their noses and behind their eyes, invading every part until they were one with it. The boys moved deeper into the silent cavern. And then came the sounds. Those horrible sounds from God only knew what. Shelley heard them coming. His ears were very keen now. Oh yes, very keen indeed. He could not see the boys yet, the boys who'd come to collect their little prizes, The silly little boys who wanted to get back to their stupid homes, their stupid lives. He couldn't see them, but he would soon be able to feel them. Eat, eat, eat. Oh yes, Shelley would eat. The fat one first, then the skinny one. Eat their eyes so they couldn't see, eat their feet next so they couldn't run away. It would be a paradise, a beautiful new world. Everyone would be so much happier down here. It would be an adjustment, of course, but they could be useful. They could be daddies, too. Yes, they could all be daddies. What a lovely idea. The sounds caused the ventricles of Newton's heart to seize up. He could actually feel them constricting with a painful squeeze. Long, liquid noises. Slurp, slurp, slurp. Flashlight, Newton said. The word came out as a compressed nugget of sound. Max flicked it on. Stark whiteness washed over the cavern. Slurp, slurp, slurp. The boys' faces were eggshell white. It was as if fear had blown the blood right out of their skin. Their necks and arms were rashed with goose flesh. The clammy rock trapped the sweet stink, making the boys dizzy with it. They were in a small antechamber, a hollow bubble in the rock. There, Newton said, pointing. The spark plugs sat in a shallow saltwater puddle in the middle of the chamber. Could it really be so simple? Max scanned the puddle for white wriggles. It was clear. He picked his way over, grabbed the spark plugs, and turned to Newton with a tentative, hopeful smile. The flashlight in his hands shone on the rock behind the other boy. He caught a sly, flinching movement to the left of Newton's waist. The spark plug slipped from his numbed hands. Newton's forehead creased as Max's hand rose, one quivering finger pointing to the spot behind him. He wheeled suddenly, stumbling, and watched in horror as it emerged. The thing that once went by the name of Shelley Longpre unfolded itself from a dark chalice in the rock, crawling out like a spider, folding each of its long, pale limbs out, unpacking itself from its hiding spot with the showy grace of a contortionist. Yes, it lisped, the hiss of an adder that crested and eddied. Yes. It was long in its extremities and bulbous in its middle. It was naked and translucent and webbed with huge blue veins that snaked over its body. Its arms and legs were nothing but bone wrapped in a thin sheath of skin. Trapped in the eye of terror, Max found himself thinking of the Christmas just past. His folks had bought him a trombone. They'd wrapped it and put it under the tree. Of course, Max knew what it was. A trombone wrapped in shiny paper looked practically the same as a trombone not wrapped in paper. That was how its legs looked, like bones wrapped in skin-colored Christmas paper. Yes. Its voice was the lonely squeal of a hermit. It scrabbled toward them with a leer of hideous glee, hideous hunger, hideous need. Its left eye was completely white. Something had sucked the pigment out of the eyeball the way a child sucks the red stripes off a peppermint candy. Its right eye was as shriveled as a dehydrated pea. White threads licked and lashed in the wide raw socket, making a whoosh sound, sort of like wind-swayed grain in a farmer's field. Max noticed clearly in its nakedness that its stomach was an obscenely pendulous appendage. The size of a beach ball, it swayed between its legs with a quivering, expectant weight. Its ribcage jutted in monstrous fingers. Huge knobs of flesh seeped filth all over its shoulders. A belt of ulcerated boils encircled its hips. Max's mind reeled. Scant days and hours ago, this thing had been a boy, not much different from him. Slurp. Its lips hung down like the lips of an old horse. Its teeth were gone. Its gums hung in whitish rags from the roof of its mouth like the pith inside a pumpkin. It reached for Newton with extremely long fingers. It had nibbled its own skin off the tips. Its voice lost its sibilance as it rose to an insane gibber.
Yeah.
Snapping out of his torpor, Newton managed to lash out with the spear. He struck the thing across its face. Its skin tore apart in crepey rags. It mewled piteously and crab-walked around the edge of the chamber, its gut dragging along the rocks. The skin mooring its belly to its abdomen stretched and tore in thin fissures. Max was horrified at the possibility that it would burst apart. What in God's name would spill out?
Go!
Newton yelled at Max. Max pressed his back to the wall and swung round. The shelly thing's tongue darted out of its mouth, a gnarled root. Max wondered if it was trying to taste his scent the way snakes do. It scuttled toward Max with horrid speed and ferocity. He caught a glance of its back. Something was twined around its spine like an electrical cord. One of its bony claws manacled round his ankle, and Max's bladder let go. Warm wetness drained down his leg. The shelly thing seemed to sense that, too. It stared up with those alabaster eyes keening and snuffling at Max's calves. Max screamed and kicked it off. The flashlight slipped from his hands and hit the ground, spinning in lazy circles. Max caught hold of Newton's arm and dragged him back toward the chamber's mouth. His mind was yammering. Soon the terror would weld it shut. The flashlight spun to a stop. Its glow climbed Newton's madly backpedaling legs. Then the shelly thing darted out of the darkness, squealing with the high excitement of a pig who'd found a truffle, clamping onto Newton's right leg.
Let go! He shrieked. Get off me!
It kept squealing and clawing up Newton's body. Newton felt the warm weight of its gigantic belly pressing between his own thighs. Beneath the sucking sounds, he could hear squirming ones coming from the wet, black hole of its mouth.
Oh, Jesus, Max, it's gonna...
When the shelly thing's stomach ruptured, it did so with a moist, ripping tear. Newton's thighs and abdomen were washed in a warm broth of desiccated organs and shrunken intestines and untold multitudes of writhing alabaster. Newton screamed in terrified disgust as the shelly thing's face relaxed into an expression of extreme contentedness. Newton kicked free and skated his heels over the slippery rock. The shelly thing toppled face forward onto the cavern floor. It landed with a sickening crunch that collapsed all the tortured bones of its face. From the sworn testimony of Stonewall Brewer, given before the Federal Investigatory Board in connection with the events occurring on Falstaff Island, Prince Edward Island. Question. Admiral Brewer, I'd like to ask about your methods regarding Tim Riggs and the five boys who were on Falstaff Island when Tom Paget arrived. Answer. Fire away. Question. I'd like to know why, during the entire course of the containment, you never tried to contact Mr. Riggs, or, after his passing, why you didn't make contact with the boys. Answer. For what reason? Question. To tell them what was happening. To let them know, if nothing else, that their parents were being forcefully detained as opposed to purposefully leaving them there. Answer. These points were duly considered and dismissed. I felt, it was best to institute a look-but-don't-touch policy. Question. You could have dropped a care package, food and aid, or notes written by their parents. That wouldn't be touching, would it? Answer. If you'll check the record of our conversation here today, you'll recall that I said, nothing comes, nothing goes. Question. But does that apply to information, Admiral? A virus cannot be born on information. Answer. But hysteria can. Information isn't always power. Information can do harm just as easily as ignorance. Say we told these boys what they were up against, okay? They may have gone, pardon my French, batshit. Question. Wouldn't you concur, Admiral, that based on the evidence of the events as we now know them, that some of those boys went batshit anyway? Answer. Hindsight being 20/20 and all, yes, I surely can. Listen, tribunals like this get held because of men like me. Question. Define for our purposes men like you, Admiral. Answer. I'm talking about men who take a line and hold to it. Some people think that makes men like me inflexible, hard-assed, at worst, inhuman.
It's true that the decisions men like me make can seem, from an outward perspective, to be that, inhuman. People will always second-guess you. Why did those people have to die? Why those 44 in the SARS outbreak? Why those kids on the island? Well, that's fine, and I accept all that. The second-guessing, I mean, not the fact that every epidemic is going to have its fair share of deaths. It's my hope and goal to have zero fatalities. But the fact is that unless men like me make those decisions, the